Matthew.
Hey, what's going on? How you doing, Mark?
We're officially rolling.
We're rolling.
All right. So another big week at the UN.
Things have been slow sometimes, but this week with the Darfur resolution, there was a day that felt like, you know, it felt like last summer and like, you
well,
know, big things.
Do tell me. I'm speaking with Matthew Lee of Inner City Press, and this is Mark Goldberg of UN Dispatch and the American Prospect. Just for our
sure. No, I'm sorry to launch into it.
Viewers out there.
That's
listeners
great.
Out there.
Definitely.
So, big week. We had the Darfur resolution passed unanimously this time at the Security Council on Tuesday, I believe.
It was on Tuesday, and it was
on Tuesday. Yeah.
Yep.
How was what was the reaction?
The
like
mood was
the
first.
Hall?
I mean, I will say, and just in terms of like the journalists here, people were like, you know, it's sort of it was a you know the stakeout area outside the Security Council was full, and all of the ambassadors wanted to speak, but in a strange way, I mean, it was portrayed. I think, you know, Ban Ki-moon was quoted, or he didn't stop and speak, by the way, but in his prepared remarks, he said that it's, you know, it was historic. I think there was a lot of people that had been following it were amazed that in the end game of the drafting of the resolution, how much got stripped out. In one sense, it's good because it shows like, you know, multilateralism. Like the Sudanese ambassador Abdul Halim Mohammed was sat up, you know, according to him and according to the English ambassador in the UK mission Sunday night. His words was cleaning up the text. And it was pretty cleaned. I mean, it passed, so you can say it's a good thing. One can say it's a good thing. But
I tell you, an issue I follow particularly closely.
Go ahead.
And this resolution is sort of unlike the others.
Yep.
For the principal reason that this is the first time that China did not abstain from the resolution, but rather voted in the affirmative for it.
Yep.
Now, in all the previous resolutions, China had worked behind the scenes to water down the text to a point where they would not veto, they would only abstain.
Yep.
However, this time, you know, they did water down the text like they do in, you know, all of the Sudanese resolutions, except, you know, they kept intact some of the important parts and ended up voting for it. You know, the important sort of part that they kept intact, of course, was the Chapter 7 resolution.
Right.
So this, you know, the hybrid UN force, so-called force of African Union troops and that are essentially under the UN command are going to be now, you know, able to, you know, provide legitimate civilian protection to people in Darfur once, of course, they actually get on the ground there.
But can I say that you're right in terms of that? That's definitely I think that like China's different position. Some people might ascribe it to like just pressure that's been brought to bear on them, the importance of the Olympics to them. It was probably also Tuesday was the last day of of July, but also the last day of China's presidency of the Security Council. So actually, some people believe that they very much wanted it passed on their presidency, so they could in the future, whatever happens, they can say, "What do you mean? We're protecting genocide in Sudan. We passed the resolution." But the one thing I would highlight in the resolution is there is chapter seven, meaning, you know, mandatory, and it does say to protect civilians. But the sentence goes on to say to protect civilians without prejudice to the responsibilities of the government of Sudan. And having talked to the Sudanese ambassador, he's their read on that, and I think the reason that they said they're happy with the resolution is that the UN force would have to, according to the Sudanese ambassador, check with Sudan before it protected civilians.
Okay, well,
you said I'm saying, which is a major.
Yes.
I'm not saying
that's certainly what the Sudanese ambassador would say.
Right. And the problem is that's what President al-Bashir is going to say, and then you're going to have the same. I don't mean to be negative about it. I'm just saying, I think that you're going to see that language is going to be the problem down the road.
I don't agree with you on this one. You know, this language, that without prejudice language, is essentially a disclaimer saying that, you know, the UN-AU hybrid force is not invading their country. However, you know, it makes clear, the resolution makes clear that, you know, the UN and the Sudanese government must, like, establish a status of forces agreement within the next 30 days. And, you know, there are consequences to not. Well, actually, I should back up. The resolution, you know, says that, you know, the UN and the AU are going to, you know, there's a clear path being laid out in which there will be sort of international forces on the ground. Mm-hmm. And this could be, you know, Sudanese government has essentially already given its consent for this force. And now, you know, it's incumbent upon the international community to keep the pressure up on Sudan in mm-hmm. order so that they don't back out from this agreement.
Exactly. I mean, I guess what the thing is, as there are, I guess I would just say, if the very day the thing is passed, the two parties, or let's say Sudan on one side and other people that voted for it, are articulating an entirely different interpretation of it that when it's passed, this yes. seems to me to be a setup for disagreements down the road. Now, maybe the disagree, you know, maybe it doesn't mm-hmm. matter. They agreed to it, and therefore, you know, the UN or the force with an African character will just take action regardless of what President Bashir says. But for some reason, I doubt that. Yes. We may disagree.
Well, I mean, you know, there's like a pattern of behavior here on the part of the Sudanese government in which they, you know, give the international community what it needs to pass, you know, this and that resolution. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, though, the Sudanese government has, you know, been, you know, simply intransigent when it comes to, when it comes to actually implementing the resolution. What makes this resolution different, in my mind, is that finally Sudan's ally on the Security Council, China, right. is on board with this resolution. So I think the value in this resolution and the benefit of this resolution is that it's the first time that you have China, Sudan's ally, you know, on board affirmatively, not simply abstaining, but voting for this right. resolution. So that will make it harder for Sudan to back out of the agreement set forth in this resolution. For example, signing the status of forces agreement within the next 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. No. I think you're absolutely. I think maybe I guess the difference is, I think the fact that it got done, that China wanted it to get done, is reflective yes. of increased pressure among the international community, and being felt both in Beijing and in Khartoum. So I think that's yes. it's part of a good trend. I'm just sort yes. of given that trend. For example, the resolution in earlier draft spelled out what would have been consequences of not complying. That
yes.
all came out. There was some sort of also language, you know, the sort of, you know, talking and
yeah.
denouncing past failure to comply. That
yeah.
came out. So I think each time we looked at the draft, it was getting
yes.
weaker and weaker. But it's still
well,
the
yes.
fact that it passed is significant.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it is significant. At the same time, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath.
Right.
Too, you know, like I said, you know, while this resolution is significant because China is for it rather than abstaining from it, you know, there's still a lot of steps that need to get done before we'll see, you know, peacekeepers on the ground
sure.
in Darfur. Mm-hmm. And there's there is a lot of opportunity for the Sudanese government to back away from it. But so far, this is the best resolution that has been passed.
Right. No. Exactly. And I mean, since mm-hmm. the thing about it is that it was inevitable mm-hmm. that something was going to happen, given that.
Yeah.
That it's been this whole cat and mouse game, but Ban Ki-moon had announced mm-hmm. a number of times that
yes.
President Bashir had made this commitment, and so it was a matter mm-hmm. of nailing it down. I agree. I'm not trying to be like overly negative about it. I guess
yeah.
I'll just. It was. People were sort of flabbergasted because there was a whole consultation process. So like for at least a week, but probably 10 days before it passed, every time mm-hmm. the ambassadors would come to the stakeout outside the Security Council, even if they were talking about something
yeah.
else. There was Georgia, there was Nepal, there was a lot of things going through, but everyone was asking about this, and each time we saw a draft, it was like, wow,
yeah.
more things out. So
that's how every draft on Darfur has been since, you know, from the first resolution in 2005 till now.
Sure.
In 2004 until now. Except, you know, this time, you know, like in those times, China has been, you know, has been taking things out of the drafts
yeah.
until it's acceptable for them to abstain. But this time, at least, they voted for it.
But, you know, it's interesting, and maybe this is, you know, maybe there, it's not the right comparison, but there have been this, you know, the similar sort of negotiation time and sort of hoopla at the end. Of on resolutions on they're both non-proliferation, but on Iran and on North Korea.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, I found myself thinking like, Sudan was smart to get involved. Like North Korea, each time there's been a resolution, you know, denouncing it for nuclear tests. And obviously that's a whole other kettle of worms. But they don't participate in the drafting. They basically, from the outset, everyone knows that they're going to denounce the resolution as impinging on their sovereignty and call the press reptiles. This is their most recent stuff. But everyone knows how it's going to go. And in a way, like, you end up with these very strong resolutions because the party being considered is so resistant to it that people are like, screw it, you know? Whereas in this case, Sudan was on the inside, China repeatedly saying we can't pass it in this form.
Yes.
Others in the African group sort of also raising some questions, and so they ended up getting a much there are no sanctions, let's put it that way.
You know? No. Well, I mean, there are sanctions, you know, there are UN sanctions on four.
Sure.
Sudanese individuals, only two of whom are members of the government of Sudan.
Right.
The other and mid-level officials at that. The other individual sanctions are against some rebel leaders.
Sure.
Are you
following, although this is not like straight Security Council, but the meeting of Darfur rebels in Arusha? No.
Do tell.
Okay, no, because this is sort of what everyone says, even the proponents of the resolution, is that, you know, the solution will be political and in order.
Yes.
This is like, you know, Jan Eliasson or Eliasson, however people want to say it. He's over there trying to see that the increasingly fractured group of rebel groups in Darfur unify so that actually some type of a peace agreement can be reached.
That was, you know, one of the one of the reasons that the Darfur peace agreement fell apart. Was because by the time, you know, in it was signed in April, May of 2006, and by the time the resolution was put forward, the Darfur peace agreement was put forward, the rebel groups had already split into, you know, three factions, and now they've split even more since then, and only one of the groups ended up signing it, and it's been the people of Darfur's detriment that the rebel groups can't get together and form one cohesive unit, like to bargain politically with the central government in Khartoum.
And this is not, obviously, I'm certainly not saying that the ambassador of Sudan is in any way reasonable, but he does talk to the press a lot here. Afterwards, and I'll ascribe, maybe I'm projecting this, but just for like the day that they were voting on the resolution on Tuesday, not down by where the Security Council is, but on the third floor where most of the press offices are, the ambassador of Sudan started talking. He just kept talking. Next thing, he's like surrounded by like 40 journalists because everybody has to write a story about it. So everyone and he's giving quotes. I mean, he's telling it like it is. Afterwards, somebody said to me that running through their mind was like, you know, stabbing with a pen. Just so you know, I just thought it was so funny. And
it's interesting. You know, I go to a lot of these events at Brookings and Carnegie that, you know, talk about Sudan, and at every event, there is a representative of the Sudanese embassy here in Washington at these events, standing up, raising their hands, and objecting point by point to every issue raised by whoever the speaker is at the time, be it Susan Rice or Andrew Natsios or whomever. And it's always kind of a hoot in a way to see these guys because, you know, they're just kind of, everyone glares at them in the audience and is like, you know, directs their ire, and the person speaking gets to sort of take their anger and aggression out on this representative of the Sudanese government. It's always kind of interesting dynamic to watch.
But what's funny here is that this guy, you know, Abdul Halim Mohammed, he's a very good advocate for them because he doesn't lose his cool. He doesn't come off as crazy. He's kind of funny. And often the journalists here find him more, for whatever his country is doing, he's actually much easier to find, and he'll, you know, any question you have, he'll answer it. What I actually, and this is maybe a critique.
So he must be a good guy.
No, but I'm not saying, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is people always will come up afterwards and say, like, they feel conflicted because the guy is kind of funny, but he represents, like, a genocide, you know, a genocidal state. Whatever. It now escapes me. That was all the preface to say, among the things that he points out, and I'd be, this is a softball maybe for you to hit this one out of the park.
Okay.
He says the international community's concern is not credible in this way. He said, like, they passed the heavy support package, and yet nothing has been provided.
Mm-hmm.
and they pay the light support package, quote unquote. And you can, you know, it only 65% is on the ground. So he's like, we've passed it, but the reality is, like if the things that were previously passed.
Well, you know, I think he's pointing to an underlying reality about, you know, the Darfur issues that at the end of the day, like, the member states don't really care about this all that much. You know, I think folks at the, you know, Ban Ki-moon and Kofi Annan before him and Jan Eliasson and all these folks at the General Secretariat, you know, work on this issue day in and day out. But, you know, in the end, they're not given that much support from their powerful member states. You know, for example, I think the U.S. has a lot going on at the U.N. and, you know, frankly, I think that the U.S. judges that Darfur is not quite the most important bilateral issue they have with China.
Right.
So that, you know, they're not going to lean on China to do something about Darfur when they need China to helping them on a host of other different issues at the Security Council, like, you know, Iranian proliferation and North Korea and all that.
Sure.
And, you know, the Darfur is still not this kind of tier one issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact, you know, and sort of the slow pace with which these support packages are being raised, and frankly, I think the slow pace at which troops will be raised for the full hybrid force is almost inevitable because it's just not that big of a priority on for people.
I mean,
and, you know, it's you know, there's a lot more talk than action there is on Darfur.
No, on that one, I would. Mm-hmm. The real kind of cautionary fact out there is that there's this AU force that, you know, the Security Council authorized for Somalia, and like
other than
Uganda, that's the only country that's there. Its mandate of six months is about to run out, and it's like it was never really done.
Yes. You know, so. Although I did see a late-breaking news today, I think from Reuters, that you know, a group of African nations have, you know, pledged to support the hybrid.
Right. Oh, yeah, I did see that. Troops. Sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, whatever that means, but, you know, at least five African nations, including Rwanda, which is, you know, for regional concerns, you know, pretty professional army, is sending their, you know, is at least willing to send their troops into Darfur.
Sure.
So, what next? You choose.
Okay. Well, I have something in my mind, but I'll put it further back. Just this morning, in terms of, you know, big picture, real world diplomacy. Here, I mean, again, some people might even say this is the unreal world of the UN, because there's been a backroom diplomacy for more than a week to do what's a presidential statement, which really doesn't have, it's not a resolution. It doesn't like force anything, but it is an expression of, you know, the thoughts and concerns of the Security Council about Lebanon. And it's been going, this thing has been pending, and it was supposed to be passed yesterday, and then there was it was said that, you know, Ambassador Khalilzad out of the United States came out and said that, you know, one member, you know, has a problem, and so we'll come back tomorrow morning. That member was Qatar.
Yes.
And the problem they had is that the presidential statement was expressing concern about Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, and a statement that he made that Hezbollah can reach any place in Israel at any time, which people interpreted to mean that Hezbollah has been, you know, in violation of Resolution 1701, importing weapons into South Lebanon.
Yes.
And which the Hezbollah people, including the person I've referred to before as Hezbollah TV, who's my line on these, not my line, but he says, yes, Nasrallah said that, but that he never said that he's imported anything. What this meant is that he always had that capability. But so Qatar made a big point of saying he shouldn't be named by name. And somebody explained this to me today, and it sort of makes sense to me, is that even though it's just a presidential statement, that if from their point of view, and by they, Qatar was the one carrying this point, if they allow this type of criticism by name, even in just what's really just a presidential statement, that could be the first step down the road toward, like, more, you know, sanctions. It would sort of be like, that thing already passed.
So they would strip down Nasrallah.
Correct. So they stripped it out. And there's even some more back. There was supposed to be a presidential statement about the humanitarian.
No, you should preface this by saying, in order for a presidential statement to pass, correct me if I'm wrong,
it has to be unanimous.
All 15 members of the Security Council have to agree.
That's why.
So
you're very good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I forgot. Yeah, that's why. Otherwise, they would have just done it 14-1. But that's the thing. You need everyone.
Yeah. It's not like a resolution or anything. It's supposed to be an expression of unity of the council.
And apparently, in
the real world, there's no unity about this.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And various people acquiesce. No, it is kind of strange when you think about it, because it's like, it has to be unanimous, but it has no effect.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, things that have effect can pass, whatever, yeah. 9-6.
Yeah, but it's almost, a heartening way that Qatar is the only country objecting to this. You know, that you have the permanent members of the Security Council are all on board.
Right.
With that condemnatory language against Hezbollah, but you have one, regional actor that is stopping it, but not even, not a regional, not a country of not a great power.
Right.
You don't have Russia or China or any European country backing, Hezbollah,
But I mean, actually, a lot of people have been saying it's hard to, Russia has been. But I think all, these guys are also, they understand the thing doesn't really have this much real world effect.
Yeah.
Maybe this will go on. I mean, the sort of next big thing coming down the pike here will be a resolution which will expand the UN's role in Iraq.
Yes. And well, the news about yesterday world, was consequences. Yeah.
Yeah. The news yesterday was that. People were very surprised that the Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, said he really doesn't have a problem
with
the resolution.
He's okay with it. So this was a resolution almost presaged by Khalil Zad's New York Times op-ed a couple weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
Arguing for a more robust role, political role, yep. I should say, for the UN in Iraq. And now the U.S. mission and the British mission put forth a resolution, outlining the kind of expanded political role that the U.N. should have in Iraq. And, surprise, surprise, the Russians agree to it, and so it looks like it's on track to pass.
Yeah, no, everyone was like, yeah, exactly. Who's against it? But it's sort of.
Yeah.
I'll actually tell you who's against it. Ready? The UN staff union, the people that actually work here, they're preparing their own resolution. It's not like they don't have the force of the Security Council, but they're preparing their own resolution for adoption Tuesday, which will say, that as a matter of like UN employees, until it's safe or they can guarantee their safety.
I mean,
go ahead.
You can't really blame them either.
Right.
Everyone who goes to Iraq is putting their life in their hands. Right now, the United Nations assistance mission in Iraq is only about 300 mm-hmm. staff members in it, and they have a pretty limited role. Their biggest sort of accomplishment was organizing that Purple Finger election back in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, the security situation has deteriorated to a point where. They're left just writing reports about human rights abuses, and their political role is limited. Interestingly, it was the Iraq Study Group, I think, that first kind of envisaged this expanded role for the UN in Iraq. This role as something of a neutral political arbitrator mm-hmm. between Iraq's various factions and Iraq's neighbors. And of course, the administration kind of threw away just about every recommendation of the Iraq Study Group, but now it seems to be coming back around to this idea that the UN does have this, positive, potentially ameliorative role to play in Iraq.
Well, I think it's been because they can't really think of any other, either way out or sort of fig leaf. I mean, I think a lot of, at least, maybe I know too many skeptics, but there are people that say, this is as a last gasp, the Bush administration trying to get the UN to take something that's clearly gone out of control, and it's kind of so. Is it a favor by this is obviously oversimplifying it, but the speed with which when Khalil Zad wrote it, I remember he said, and Ban Ki-moon agrees with me that the UN should be more involved.
Yeah.
The question, there's two different and this is again probably way too cartoon-like, but the question is, does Ban Ki-moon favor this because he's a pro-American guy and that's why he was put here? Or does he favor it because it would increase the UN's stature and credibility if on this incredibly, important global thing it had a bigger role, right?
Or, does he favor it because it's the right thing to do, because the UN has...
oh, there is that, of course.
Well, has the capability of it, to the extent that a political solution is possible, and bringing together the various Iraqi factions and regional actors, the UN has a role to play. Now, the situation may be beyond, repair. The UN, may not be able to accomplish this, even if, despite their best efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So success here is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a foregone conclusion.
The contrary. But this is not a rhetorical question. So some people have said a lot of it will will ride on kind of the prestige and credibility of who the UN would send. And so I'm kind of at a loss of, like, do you even know, you know, obviously Tony Blair is already, not that he has
that. Well, I mean, back in 2004, you know, Lakhdar Brahimi was there.
Right.
And he was able to, you know, stake out a compromise between Sistani, who at the time, you know, was a big player, to get him to agree to the political process. You know, he was the Brahimi was the intermediary between the Americans and Sistani, because Sistani wouldn't talk to the Americans.
Yep.
And, you know, there was that brief moment where a political solution was possible. You know, that was the result of, you know, Brahimi's work behind the scenes. And, of course, you know, we haven't mentioned this yet, but the reason that so many UN staff members are so reluctant about this expanded role was the, you know, bombing of the UN headquarters back in, you know, the summer of 2003 that killed Sergio Vieira de Mello.
Yep.
And, you know, so their concern, I think, is not without reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, that's totally what they're tying it to. But, no, absolutely. Yeah. And I feel, given how serious, I mean, I almost didn't, I didn't say that, but you're up. So that's the total base of their concern.
Yeah.
That was, and also that was, I mean, he was one of the UN's, like, you know, very much of a bright star that they could send to solve problems.
And he was like he was friends and colleagues with a lot of people back at UN headquarters.
Sure.
And they knew him personally, and you know his death really did send shockwaves.
Right.
Through the system.
I think that, I guess, and I don't mean to get back into the kind of this, the you know, the nitty gritty world of who the UN would send and who.
Yeah.
I think that there, I will say this, and I don't, without, there seems to be a, it's not like, you know, some people were saying, within the, one thing that's happened since we last spoke is that the you know, Ban Ki-moon's, the person that he promoted to be his representative to the Middle East Quartet and kind of advisors on all thing Middle East is a guy called Michael Williams. He'd been, and this was a bit, you know, it was a pretty high profile announcement. Like this is going to be Ban Ki-moon's envoy to the Middle East. And what's emerged is that the guy is leaving. He's leaving. In fact, today it was confirmed by the foreign, you know, in the UK that he's going to be Gordon Brown's representative to the Middle East.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of, like, and even this guy, I don't know how high, within the UN system he was high profile, whether outside he was. But there's a sense among some here that, like, Ban Ki-moon would really, to have the UN be kind of a, you know, a credible mediator and a player in Iraq, he really is going to have to recruit somebody. It's not like a big name, but in a sense it is. And if he can't keep Michael Williams, who's he going to get to do this job in Iraq? Then again, it's not all him.
I think the difference between sort of the two jobs here is that the sort of U.S. and Great Britain, the Security Council, seem poised to empower the U.N.'s sort of guy in Iraq or woman in Iraq. However, the U.N.'s quartet representative is sort of by design, by the Security Council's design, someone who does not have a lot of power.
Yep.
Alvaro de Soto, who you know, you mentioned previously, you know, in that long, scathing letter or sort of review of his time on the job, he compared himself to that sort of knight from the Monty Python.
His arms cut off,
arms and legs cut off, and you know he just has, you know, he's powerless because, you know, the U.S. and the European Union and principally the U.S. I think is unwilling to grant the U.N.'s representative to the quartet that much power, and so there's then the all the power he has is power that's only given to him by member states. However, in Iraq, the U.S. at least, and Great Britain seem poised to want to empower the U.N.'s actor.
That would help them recruiting somebody. Right.
Yes.
No, sure. Yeah, no, exactly. And it's not to be, it's just there are increasing rumblings here of sort of like whether they, what they need to do to bring in new players, or there's still a problem with them even finding like special representatives to countries like Ivory Coast or Sudan. It could be another problem, but there's still you know, we were 7 months into the Ban administration and there's still a lot of unfilled spots and people sort of scratch their head at some of the ones how they're being filled, but that's a whole other topic.
So new topic.
Nope.
What do you got?
I am going to go. I'm compelled to say this. I don't mean to
speak away.
Absolutely. And this may be a little bit too inside the UN, but I think to
that's why we have you on here.
To,
you
know? I know. I'm probably. This may be even too inside the UN. There's something called. I won't even preface it. I'll say there's something called.
I should say. Because it's inside the UN, you should speak only an acronym.
Oh, okay. No. I'll try to. I will, and then you can. UNCG. No. There's something called the United Nations Communications Group, and what it involves is the head of communications of the Secretary General. In this case, it's this guy Mike Meyer, not Myers, Meyer from formerly of Newsweek, and then the lead spokespeople of all the UN funds, programs, and specialized agencies. And they get together once a year, and it seems like a good idea to sort of think about the UN's communication strategy, right?
Okay.
So I'd never, so be it. I was given a heads up right after the meeting took place that some bad.
When was the meeting?
The meeting took place in Madrid in June 21st and 22nd.
Okay.
And they. You know, I can't. I'll just tell it this way. I heard some. You know, that there were some. They discussed new media and the way in which the UN should deal with new media. So that sounds. And I was told that in fact the way they discussed it is they were saying, they don't really like being covered by quote bloggers or media that they find.
Did you
doesn't
take that
have
as a personal slight, Matthew?
I'm told actually that Inner City Press came up by name. That's why it's a little.
Okay.
I'm doing it in this format. It probably would be. I'm probably too close to it to report on it for any. But for Blogging Heads TV, I think not that it's a low standard, but I feel that people that are the viewers and readers and readership and listeners of Blogging Heads TV. It's interesting that and so I'll go further into it. So then I asked at one of the noon briefings here, could we have a readout on the meeting? And they said yes. They on this topic they talked about how the UN can better engage with new media to get its message out. But in fact, I later got the minutes of the meeting, and there's the minutes even they are pretty sanitized. But the minutes say we need to rethink granting accreditation to media that doesn't have a traditional editor function whereby the UN can have recourse to have corrections, which I don't. It's a funny way to think because, in fact, I'll just say this self-servingly. But the few times that that a UN agency has said that's incorrect, always run a correction. But I think and I've been actually having written on this topic and been getting feedback from. It's strange. It's sort of like the UN is that I guess it's all government agencies and stuff are trying to figure out how do you deal with a non-traditional media structure. But the UN, I think they're so basically. I can say this: two UN funds and programs at this meeting in Madrid stated openly, we're not going to answer. We don't answer questions from bloggers. They don't and they don't care the size, the readership. They sort of are. The question is. For an international organization that's trying to reach the public, do they get to choose what journalism is, or do they have to kind of deal with journalism as it's developed in order to get the message out to people? Go ahead.
Let me throw the question back to you.
Please.
What criteria? First, do you think the UN and its agencies should have sort of criteria for accrediting journalists and bloggers? And if so, what should that criteria be?
Number one, they should answer questions that come across the idea of that one thing. Well, I'll get back to that in terms of how they answer questions. The only, I guess, reason for their accreditation, and they use this as the rationale, is a space limitations.
That UN press room is not that big.
You know, it's fun. It's getting bigger all the time. There's been the trend here is UPI. For what it's worth, they're closing. But a number of places there's less media coverage here. In fact, that's been something that people have been discussing. But I mean, every government agency can choose who to let in the door. In New York City, who can cross the police lines to cover a fire. But it seems to me, unless you get into judging media based on the content, which I don't think is a way they want to go. All you have to show is a readership. It seems to me you're reaching people.
Big of a readership? I mean, I don't know. So is your criteria then sort of, do you think that the UN, to accredit bloggers, the bloggers should have to prove that they have a certain threshold of readers?
I guess I'm saying if the idea is that there's limited space, that would be a better criteria than them. What happens here is that as I hear this from a number of my colleagues in the press corps, when they come up for reaccreditation, there are people in the UN that feel that it's entirely legitimate to read their coverage and say, I don't like this.
Okay.
Somebody said, well, you've shown me the articles you've written, but let me see the full publication because I want to see what the editorial stance is. And that's like, I mean, I think we would both agree that probably like
sure.
City Hall in New York and I mean, maybe the Bush administration would want to do mm-hmm. that. But that clearly like runs afoul of like the First Amendment.
Yeah, know. No, I you know, agree. At the same time, I haven't heard sort of a good answer from you, though.
Good. I'm only saying in terms of readership.
What criteria should an organization
I'll throw it back to you.
To credit new media?
I guess I'm just saying, for example, if you can only, let's say, mm-hmm. during the General Assembly, Hugo Chavez comes, and let's say the briefing room only has 64 chairs, it doesn't seem insane to me to say, if you're writing for a newsletter for three people, maybe we don't give you the chair. You know what I mean? If you're trying to allocate limited space, then I think you might want to modify it by saying, like, there are publications with a relatively smaller readership but a more interest. You'd want to somehow balance it geographically, right? I'll be honest with you. Nothing in the discussion that this UN communication group had was about lack of space in the media room here. In fact, if anything, the UN is having a hard time getting people to cover it. I attend briefings here where in the 20 minutes before they do a briefing, there's a lot of things on climate change. The UN's expert on climate change, Ivo de Boer, came and spoke, and they couldn't find people to go to the briefing room. I mean, I go.
Okay.
It's not out of a favor. I'm just saying it's not the UN headquarters is not – there's not a lack of space for reporters to cover it. So I don't think that's the rationale. I think you're – I mean, it's a very – it's a good question, I'm uncomfortable saying it.
But, I mean, VDAR.com, you know, that right – the borderline – well, it's a white supremacist, you know, website has a huge readership.
Sure.
You know, should they be granted, you know –
Well, no, that – well, that's – I mean, then I think – exactly. I mean –
accreditation or –
or Megadeth.
I mean, or you know, the you know – listservs for heavy metal groups, or, you know, it just seems like it's a really hard, and I think, like, every organization is struggling with this right now. Now, I, as a, you know, loud and proud member of the new media, I'm all for, you know, the new media covering everything everywhere all the time.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm sympathetic to you here, but, you know, it is, you know, I think an organization like the UN does have legitimate concerns. You know, when it tries to decide, you know, how or if to credit bloggers.
Right. I guess, but here's the thing. I guess I'm saying this much more experientially. For example, I cover the UN development program, UNDP.
Yeah.
And obviously some of the coverage is sort of investigative and they don't really like it. But the reality is like I've come to realize, like, they really don't get a lot of inquiries. I mean, it's not like... It seems like there are many of these funds, and I know the press people of you know, WFP, UNICEF, most of these people want, and it varies by agency. I'm not sure historically why some are more open to the media than others, but they want to have inquiries. You know what I mean? I mean, in the sense, whereas UNDP has basically adopted a policy of, like, here's I know a freelance journalist who will remain unnamed, but a pretty well-known freelance journalist, sometimes writing for places as, you know, as renowned as the Wall Street Journal and sometimes others. And UNDP adopts the approach of saying, okay, you've asked us some questions, but what publication are you writing this for? And then they'll call the editor of that publication to make sure. So I guess what I'm saying is that they're allocating their answer is going to be based on the perceived, I guess, influence of what you're writing for.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not a lack of time. I've gone over there and they have a whole floor of press people. But I think that they basically will decide if they think that the coverage is in any way critical, they won't even answer factual questions. Anyway, I know I'm sort of veering off a little bit there, but I think there's I guess I'll cut to the chase. This discussion of trying to move backwards in terms of being less accessible to the media didn't take place under Kofi Annan. Even in the days in which like Oil for Food was taking place and there was a lot of negative coverage, to my knowledge, they didn't try to throw journalists out that attacked them. They did. There's a sort of famous incident where Kofi Annan said to this James Bone, who writes for the Times of London, "You're an overgrown schoolboy and you're too cheeky." But nobody tried to throw anyone out. And I think there's a sense, hopefully it won't go down that road, but there seems to be a sense that in the ban, it's not just that I read an editorial or op-ed today from the Canberra newspaper in Australia saying that ban is inept with the press. But inept is one thing, but sort of paranoid and not and trying to sort of preclude press coverage is something else. So I think one of the reasons when I saw it, I don't really know how real the threat is.
The sort of union of new media, you know, UN coverage bloggers, you know, feel for your perceived persecution, Matthew.
Well, I know. I mean, you've found that it's sort of. I mean, I'm always interested in the idea of, like, the UN does a lot of good things, but it's sort of like it should live up to its principles. So I don't mean to. This is the least of it. But we can talk about peacekeepers in the Congo. We can talk about any number of things. There was a protest here about a month ago. There was an event on the lawn of the UN, sponsored by Dow Chemicals, as luck would have it, for an environmental run around the world called Blue Planet Run. But the whole thing, they were like Dow Chemical banners, and it was the UN with Dow.
Okay.
And these two young women protesters suddenly unveiled a banner, you know, saying like, Dow, you're destroying the environment.
Yeah.
And the UN, and so they were hustled off by security. So I like follow them, and the guard says to me, you know, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm covering this. He's like, go back and cover the event. And it just struck me, like, the UN goes all around the world.
It wasn't New York police?
No, it wasn't. This was UN security.
UN police, yeah.
And I went out of my way. It's not like their fault. Like, there had to be some training to say, it's if you choose to partner on UN grounds with Dow Chemical, it's entirely foreseeable that there will be a protester. I don't know how they got in. God bless them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But and so the UN will, you know, not preach, will preach correctly to countries around the world to, like, you know, allow a free press and not, you know, fire on crowds and stuff. So, like, it seems like, especially on something, you know, it may be minor, but that's, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I love this stuff. I'm here, so I cover it.
No,
but
no,
I think it's, you know, it's living up to, you know, and the thing is that the real thing, and this is not against anyone, but one of the things of, you know, either new media or kind of like narrow casting is that you can cover things that, you know, the New York Times and the Wire services, you know, they're going to cover the Darfur resolution. Are they going to cover not just the two Dow Chemical protesters, but just a variety, even the staff union saying we don't want to go to Iraq is viewed as a kind of an in-house dirty laundry story. But it's really—it's actually not that small a story, you know.
No. So, listen, I agree, and you know, I want you to keep on blogging.
No. My hope is actually that more people.
UN, you say the trend is one way. I think at some point the UN is going to be, you know, forced to come to terms with a set of criteria to accredit, you know, new media and bloggers. Of course, you know, it's a question facing, you know, institutions from sort of the Democrat and Republican parties to the White House to all over the world is sort of how to come up with a set of standards to accredit bloggers, because we are a diverse bunch and of diverse quality.
Yep.
Your quality though is never in question, Matthew.
Okay. Actually, my quality of this broadcast, it's still recording, but it may be that my image has frozen, so...
Okay, well, we should end it here, then.
Okay, all right. No, it's fine.
Right.
I literally just noticed this. I don't know how long I've been frozen for, but it's okay.
Right.
I look sort of demented.
I actually do have to get going.
No, sure.
Well, good chatting, Matthew.
No, definitely. And thanks for indulging me at the end, but there are real... The Darfur thing, I think that's something that needs to be... Because there's a sense of, like, it passed... I saw some stories saying, like, everything is solved, and as I think we can...
Yes.
One thing we can both agree on
is
that very little has been solved.
Right.
But,
you got me there.
Okay.
All right.
Not trying to get you.
Weekend.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.